South.
Blog Talk Radio.
They are.
Good evening. It's Jane Hoffman with Blog Talk Radio. It's getting to the edge of being on February 2015. Here's an introduction while we open up the show.
Are so powerful. They have a country named after them. They are the Saud family of Saudi Arabia.
I'm a Saudi. You're a Saudi. She's a Saudi means you belong to that family.
Saudi Arabia is a dictatorship managed by a democracy. We're really talking about a core group of maybe 15 to 30 princes that are really controlling the final decision on everything.
A kingdom the size of Western Europe, with a quarter of the world's known oil deposits, riches that could tip the balance of global history. But with an increasingly radical populace and a resource that won't last forever, is the sun setting on the House of Saud.
A remarkable family and it's held on to a fairly fragile country.
They all know their survival depends upon staying together and staying in power.
Hello, this is Jane Hoffman, and I'm going to, John's going to be starting the show soon. I'm going to be playing some audio while we're waiting, and then I will jump into my introduction.
Point to Middle Eastern oil as one of the most pressing problems facing their countries. And to many, one nation is synonymous with foreign oil, Saudi Arabia. It was called the day the West woke up. The fact that 15 of the 19 terrorists on September 11, 2001 were Saudi nationals surprised some. Saudi Arabia has been a close ally of both Europe and the United States, but this seemingly worldly group of princes and kings has had a long-lasting alliance with a branch of Islam that has little fondness for the West.
Saudi royal family funded the extremists for years. I mean, we're talking about going back to the 30s, back to independence. So these people really control the media today. And therefore, they control the schools, and they have great access to propagating their ideas.
In 2005, the country crowned a new monarch, King Abdullah. He promised a new era of reforms.
Our opinion inside the CIA was that Abdullah was more capable than many of the other princes. I mean, this is good news for Saudi Arabia.
He's making an alliance more with the liberals in order to push the kingdom in the 21st century.
A delicate balance, but some fear the fundamentalists in Saudi Arabia may turn and bite the hand that
I'm going to bring John to the show now. Here he is. Hi, John.
Well, greetings, Hammer, and how are you?
It's 2 a.m. in Minnesota. I'm on my A game. How about you?
I think I can pull in my A game. Newsflash just in, American Idol has announced that King Simon Cowell and Queen Paula Abdullah will be ruling Saudi Arabia next year. For the new season, of course.
I need a one-liner joke tonight. So I was reviewing some YouTube tapes, and mainly they talk. I do know more about the foundation and the history of Saudi Arabia, but most of the YouTube tapes I watched tonight have to do with Saudi exploitation of being over wealthy, buying yachts on the French Riviera, having their own 747s. Spending money, having cocaine runs and prostitution by a handful of the princes. Now, that's probably not true for all of the princes, but being that there's 5,000 direct heirs now of the original king that was crowned, Abd al-Aziz ibn Saud, 1932, who produced 45 songs. There's.
He was a busy guy.
Ever since Pardon?
He was a very busy guy. I'm surprised he didn't have time. You know, he had time to do anything else. 45 kids.
Well, in Saudi law or the Quran law, you can only have four wives at once. So what he did is he married four, then divorced some and married some more. And in the end, he had 20 wives and 45 kids. And they don't count daughters in Saudi Arabia. So,
wow.
X number of daughters. And since that time, only his sons have ruled since 1932 to present day.
Wow. That's an exclusive club.
Yeah, now what's happened is there's two problems in Saudi Arabia structurally. The first problem is they've been increasing their lineage exponentially since for 65 to 70, what, 1904, let's see here, 30, about 80 years. And then if there's public dissent over what they do, they either get exiled, pushed out, killed, and no public display of anger is or protest is allowed in that country. So if you have a beef with the government, you don't have the right to protest.
Right. You know, it's kind of like the way God runs things, really. You know, in heaven, he's the final authority. So it's a little taste of that. It's kind of interesting that you know, the way it's set up. Like the guy who's replacing him is 79. You kind of think, like, wouldn't you want someone a little younger? But I guess it's kind of a succession in the pecking order. You know, at 79, I mean, my mom passed away. She had kind of a little bit of Alzheimer's. I just, I wonder if he's operating with a full deck at 79.
Well, I did read recently, and I'm trying to pull the article up. Every time somebody dies, they name the successor plus the number two in command. And
as I was telling
you on the phone today, the number two in command, which I will get his name up in a second, he is not a brother or grandson of the original Saud. So he in Canada ran an article about it. I didn't see any other major news publications. But the new guy... I'm trying to find it. Well, anyways, the new guy is a reformist, and I think his name starts with the N, and he's not a direct member of the group. So, and I guess he's popular among the younger crowd. Now, I want to mention also that about, I think, 25 to 50%. No, wait. Something like 30% of the youth under 25 are gainfully unemployed. And there is no trickle-down theory. I don't think they've created enough legitimate jobs for the younger generation. NAYEF is the name, N-A-Y-E-F. Here's what the Canadian article had to say. The kingdom and the royal family will not be able to move forward unless Nayef has the religious establishment at his side. It will be very difficult because religious leaders are generally older and their base is strong. So it's kind of like a generational clash.
Right.
He studied abroad, and he privately holds more socially liberal positions, including educational reform. Can you take a wild guess at what year in the 20th century women were able to become educated?
I would say maybe in the last 8 years. Let's say like 2007, maybe?
2008? 1965.
Wow. Hey, they're ahead of me.
But you know what? You can become a doctor, a female doctor in Saudi Arabia, but you still can't drive.
Really?
Yeah, they don't allow women to drive ever.
Wow. But they can cut you open. Or at least
that would actually
say,
be a blessing more than a curse. I mean, I would like some man driving me around my whole life.
Well, I guess they figure, you know, the women have been for years telling men to say "aw," so there you go.
Well,
now
let's,
they can be doctors.
We have 20 minutes, and the reason why we are a political organization here on the radio sometimes, I wanted to mention a few components of the past. Now, in 1902, a direct descendant of Muhammad Saad, 20-year-old Abdi al-Azid ibn Saad, he rode out through the desert with 60 of his brothers and cousins to restore the rule of al-Saad. The Ottoman Empire was still making a strong impact in the area, and they had captured the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. So this young 20-year-old guy recaptures Riyadh, the capital, and then he contracted two sets of nomadic warriors named, well, the Bedouins were never warriors, but they're the most famous nomadic group almost in the world, and the Ikhwan, who were Muslim brothers. The Ikhwan wanted to start a fervent sect of Muslims called the Wahhabi, and they were puritanical, but what happened was, is after they won the war, this, I'm just going to call him Abd Saad, he iced them out, he killed them, and then the way that he did that is he sought the approval of the ulama, which is the highest religious authorities. It's kind of like the religious version of the Supreme Court in our country. They're moral guardians, and they allowed him to kill these people. Now, as time went on, they established their kingdom. In 1947, the United States started mining oil there. Actually, I think it was almost in the late 30s. We needed... The two times that we appealed to Saudi Arabia for oil was during World War II and Vietnam, when we need extra oil reinforcements. And I wanted to tell you about two secret agreements with FDR and Eisenhower, but before I get into that, I'll ask you another trivia question. Were you old enough to remember the oil embargo of 1973?
Oh, yes, quite. Yeah.
I think it turned to four times the amount of what... It went from like 50 cents to $2.
Right, because we'd never seen gas, you know, skyrocket like that. And we used to have to... you'd have to get gas on certain days. Like, it'd be Monday, Wednesday, and Friday if your license plate ended in a certain number, like I think evens and certain alphabet. And then if it was then Tuesday... Thursday, Saturday, and so forth. It basically was just based on your, you know, plate numbers. And of course, we had Jimmy Cotta come in and inherit a lot of that mess. And got even a little messier with the hostages in Iran. But what's interesting is that is how Saudi Arabia does is the biggest funder of terrorists in the world, as far as I read.
Well, you know, I don't think they did it directly, but you want to hear an interesting thing?
Go for it.
They got in a fight with Nasser of Egypt in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
In the spring of 67, President Nasser of Egypt moved troops to the Israeli border, and the Israelis got scared, so they did a preemptive attack. And then they wiped out any Arab intruder. They annihilated them. Now, Nasser in Egypt was still pissed at the Saudis, but the Saudis did riot against the U.S., and the U.S.-controlled company Aramco, it stands for something like the Saudi American something company.
Uh-huh.
There was a threat at that time. Okay, the Arab League pressures King Faisal, who was the ruler of Saudi Arabia at the time, to use Saudi oil as a weapon against the West. But he didn't. 6 years later, he did, after the Yom Kippur War of 1973, where the Israelis trounced the Arabs again. In the midst of that war, the U.S. airlifts supplies to Israel, and the Arab League pressures Faisal for an oil boycott. This time he did it. They kept their oil off the market, and that's why the prices quadrupled.
You know, it's really
interesting. Now, we were really suffering then because we were in the middle of a high-scale war in Vietnam, and we basically didn't have enough oil to fight that war. Now, something turned in our favor. King Faisal, the one who temporarily withheld oil from us, on the morning of March 25th, one of his nephews kills him in cold blood because another one of his nephews had protested against the royal families in 1965 and been killed on television, and the brother came back for vengeance. So then in 75, the embargo was lifted by King Khalid, the successor. But the Saudis have been in bed with the West for a long time. They made a lot of deals throughout the 30s and 40s with us.
Right.
And they were never really 100% truly convicted to the Arab world. But at one point, and I can't remember if it was in the 60s, there was what the Saudi government did is they allowed Egypt did not tolerate Muslim extremists for a period of time. So the Saudis let extreme groups move into their country, and that's what started the underground terrorist movement.
Yeah, in fact, Hillary Clinton claims that, you know, they fund the most money to, like, the Sunnis and other groups that are extreme. It's interesting. I was kind of looking at terrorism globally, and I just happened to take a quick look at the Soviet Union and with the KGB, and one of the things they talked about is that airplane hijacking is my own invention. This is coming from the KGB, from Alexander Sakharovsky. And then another high up in the KGB at the time, which isn't no more, but used to be, he said, explained, killing one Jew far away from the field of battle is more effective than killing 100 Jews on the field of battle because it attracts more attention. And, you know, I just started thinking about how some of those philosophies, you know, with taking the planes and crashing them into buildings and how, again, killing Jews. I mean, it's on the front page news, you know, Jews versus Muslims. And basically, even though we think of Saudi Arabia as a friendly country, it does, there's so much money, and it mixes with the West and the Middle East that they are able to fund a lot of these terrorist groups, and it kind of gets under the radar. It kind of makes me wonder, too, besides terrorism, is in a way, you know, like the Middle East, it's kind of like the whole Muslim world. It's part of poisoning the planet with oil, with the pollution from it. And we're kind of the co-contributors. I mean, we're creating all the industry and the machinery.
I don't think it's really much. It doesn't have a lot to do with pollution anymore because they've built technology. Like when Saddam Hussein burned his oil wells, yeah, that was a major pollutant. But the refineries in Saudi Arabia are under control, John.
But, I mean, the oil goes to all the cars and planes and, you know, all the industrial.
You mean like the CO2 level and the toxicity
right.
of the CO2 level?
Right.
Well,
so
we are an oil-dependent nation, and we've created that in a post-industrial age. Now, can I mention one thing? Because I forgot two crucial points. Mm-hmm. In 1945, the U.S. Needed oil facilities to supply forces in World War II, as I did mention. But meanwhile, security is at the forefront of King Abd al-Aziz's concerns. Now, he's the one who rules since 32. President Franklin Roosevelt invites the king to meet him on board a Navy ship called the USS Quincy. The two leaders cement a secret oil deal security pact. The king guarantees to give the U.S. secure access to Saudi oil in exchange for the U.S. providing military assistance and training to Saudi Arabia to build the Drafan military base. Now, I do want to bring up one point about terror, and I did find the part about the extremisms being invited in the country. Now, you know that we trained at the Al-Qaeda when the Soviets were in Afghanistan.
Right.
So we did contribute to the cultivation of a so-called terrorist group that later turned on us.
Right. They felt betrayed because we really kind of abandoned them and didn't help them against the Soviets. And it's understandable, too, from their perspective. You know, just like
we didn't try to cultivate them, but at that time they were freedom fighters against a despotic regime known as Russia.
Right, they kind of served our purposes to counterbalance the Soviets. So it's one of those things, it's like from the perspective of a gangster or a mafioso or, you know, some thug on the street, if someone's helping and working with you and suddenly they stop doing that, you naturally feel like you've been betrayed. So part of their anger is justified from the street level, you know, not from, maybe from our perspective, of course, but, you know, I can feel the rage, yeah.
See, the part of the problem that breeded the terrorists in Saudi Arabia, though, was the royal family not acting in an Islamic puritanical way, because once they got rich and started doling money around and mismanaging spending and not directing resources where they wanted to, there were different factions within the country that disapproved of those behaviors, and it was retribution on their own behavior.
That's interesting. So it's kind of, in a weird way, you know, you take capitalism in America and American Christian values, and it kind of gets a little decadent. When you throw it over to the you know, Muslim world, and they go crazy with it, living excessive.
Well, I wouldn't say crazy, because we're the ones who had a charter to go over there. Actually, I don't have the data in front of me, but in the 30s, the Americans chartered a big geographic expanse of land in Saudi Arabia for gold, and they didn't know that there was a giant oil reserve underneath the ground.
Right.
So we're the ones who cultivated it for our own use, and we can't really blame the Saudis for co-opting they were the beneficiaries of our system.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is that whatever value system you have, whether you're Christian or Muslim or a communist or socialist, you know, whether you're like Russia or China, you start mixing capitalistic values or capitalistic principles, you get a lot of money. And it just, people with a lot of money, it tends to spoil them. You know, they kind of go to the most decadent level. And, you know, whether it's a Japanese businessman or, some Chinese, group of people, they're controlling. I mean, they're using all the money, the benefits of it, but they're not doing it for necessarily to save the world or, you know, help people. It's just to live decadently or to exploit. So it's kind of interesting how that, you know, how it affects the morality of the culture.
Well, I
and
think,
it,
you know,
go ahead.
Like, I can't, I was watching a 2020 special by ABC tonight on the Saudi family. I think it's, you know, sometimes you have to take those intellectual segments with a grain of salt. Like, there was a handful of the princes involved in cocaine and prostitution, but I'm sure not more than 15 to 20% are behaving like that in the family. At least I'm praying not. It kind of is a disappointment on humanity. But in one case, they taped the Saudi princes in Monaco at a club named Jimmy's with prostitutes and drugs. And one of the security guards chased them when they left. And they at gunpoint, they made ABC. They actually destroyed all their video footage and all their camera equipment.
Well, and certainly if we look at like certain leaders, like whether Saddam Hussein or others with his sons, And you watch the lifestyle that they have. I mean, they would just go in and take a girl and, you know, just rape her and deflower her and she basically make her a pariah among the community and throw them away. And it's kind of like just common, just wild behavior. And you kind of just see culturally just how people... Now, it's interesting. You have certain people, like take like a Warren Buffett. He lives in the same place. I think he lives in Nebraska. But, you know, they basically same house. Donates a lot of his money to charities. You know, I don't know. Maybe he sacrifices children in his back barn. But the point is, he lives basically a normal style. He doesn't go over the top. But you see, with a lot of
Jimmy
cultures,
Carter's another example of someone who still builds for Habitat for Humanity and does a lot
right.
of humanitarian work.
Does a lot of good work, and then you see other, you know, people in cultures. You just give them a lot of money, whether they're Muslim, Christian, or whatever their faith system, it's like they go crazy. I mean, they just can't handle it. They live an excessive lifestyle. I had a friend who was this Saudi prince was in the States, and he would like call him over his house, like, can you come over here and, you know, I have a telescope. I don't know how to focus it. Can you do? And he came over there and he like spent 5 minutes, adjusted it for him. The guy, oh, like, here's, you know, $500 or $1,000. This is
so
back,
whose
like, 30
friend
year.
Was this?
It's a friend of mine in San Jose. I'm trying to think of his name. It's kind of like one of those when you were in church and high school going into college and you had like the circle of friends. And this guy was really cool. And his name will come to me probably after the show's over. But the funny thing is, I mean, he's down-to-earth, real cool guy. And he said, I spent 5 minutes adjusting. You know, he kind of had a southern drawl, too. Oh, I kind of helped the prince adjust his telescope. And he gave me $1,000, and, you know, back then that'd be like giving you, $5,000 or $10,000. And the point is, the prince had no concept of money. You know, it was just like, he opened my car door, here's $1,000, you know, just whatever. There's
yeah, I know, they were talking on the video how, like, these two Scandinavian prostitutes would get $20,000 to $30,000 a night. Because
oh, yeah.
If they really liked you, they'd just toss money at you.
And they would start to see, like, oh, we can just control everything with just with money. Like, walk into a club. I want the club tonight. You know, here's $100,000. Here's $1,000,000. You would do whatever. I got millions and gazillions. And here's a girl. Do this for me. Boom. Here's some money. Throw it at them. And
sometimes I think all power does corrupt.
When you get to that level, then you see it with our superstars. You see with all these, you know, musical icon.
Oh,
people.
We have a caller, John.
Oh,
should I see if they want to talk?
Yeah, see if they're for real or if they're a prank caller. Maybe it's a prince or someone. He wants to give us money.
Hello, this is Jane. someone from the 918 is calling in. Would you like to say anything?
Well, I was just wondering how you thought the Shaw's family fit in all this. I was just curious.
The Shaw? The Shaw of Iran?
Right.
Well, I did a paper. I have a master's in political science. I did a paper on Mossadegh, who was a democratic leader in Iran, who was overthrown and then put on
right.
house arrest. And I was a supporter of him because, based
really?
On what I saw in the British, how they exploited the oil industry in Iran, they basically enslaved the Iranians and made them, you know. Like almost like slaves in the society of the oil industry, and then Mossadegh reformed that, and he nationalized the oil industry and kicked out the Brits. And I had a roommate in college in 1979 who left Iran right around that time that the Shah was deposed and Khomeini took over, and I believe that he was kind of. I don't want to, like, pigeonhole all, you know, Western-style leaders as corrupt, but the Iranians were very
wow.
dissatisfied with the way he behaved and how he co-opted his luxury with the United States and kind of self-protected himself in a crisis and avoided the real problems of Iran.
Oh, by the way, with our guest, I didn't catch the name. And did you have relatives or any connection or experiences with you know, Iran or with other countries, Middle East, that, you know, sparked your interest?
Well, I do know Prince Darius. His grandfather had been the Shah of Iran, and it's interesting history. And
if
his uncle had not become the Shah of Iran, it would be a different story. The original Shah was so much better.
That's, you know, it's
really?
Amazing in dealing with that. Well, go ahead, Jane. You were going to say.
No, I'd rather listen to what she has to say.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I found out a lot about the family, like who killed who, and it's not a good family to go to the family reunion. It's, you know, they disconnect respirators. His mother was murdered in France, and it's just kind of bizarre, just really bizarre in how much our government is involved in that family. It's really bizarre.
Yeah, we invest, unfortunately, in with people with money or oil or power, and it's a strange balance of power. I will say this: like I thought, I grew up in high school through kind of the Jimmy Carter era, and
mm-hmm.
being a Christian, I was like, oh, you know, we got a guy in there who believes in God, and he's trying to put, you know, be humanitarian and Jesus values. And it just seems like in certain parts of the world, that attitude is abused. You know, it's taken advantage of, and it's not respected. It just seems like we get walked over when we do that. And it's a brutal culture where they're used to just kings, you know, waking up one day and killing any relative that's in their way. Or people uprising and taking over, killing the king, and it's like a day-to-day kind of existence. It's a very, you know, brutal. Like, it's really rare that you wake up and see, Obama's, brother-in-law killed him last night, and he's running the White House. You don't quite see that dynamic over here.
Well, the show was different, though. The show was different. He had a hospital built, universities.
Many Iranians were educated there. I met.
Yes.
I attended a college where there were some Iranians. They were highly educated, and the Shah ruled from 1941 until 1979, which is a long time.
Mm-hmm.
He did establish a. He was well liked by the people who were educated, not necessarily wealthy, but the people who prospered under his rule. So
usually we'll see.
I'm talking about the first Shah. You know, first Shah was good.
And
yeah.
It kind of muddies the water because you see people, I mean, even, you know, whether it's a Muslim extremist or even mafia, they put money into the community and into good things. So it's very confusing because you see a lot of good stuff going on. I had my first job in L.A. I worked for a company where the owner came from Iran to the middle of the hostage era. And so when he came over here, I mean, he didn't know the language, and he was in high school. And he and his brother would get beat up regularly, because they were Iranian, people thought that
they were different,
that they were part of the hostage thing, and they were a well-to-do
mm-hmm.
family that escaped and got out of there before Khomeini came in and just really shook things up. And so I've kind of seen, you know, both sides of it, where the culture really shifted, when kind of the religious factions start taking control. So,
it was horrible because I had friends that lived over in Iran. I was raised up in oil. And,
yeah,
you know,
are you from Oklahoma, by the way?
Yes, I am.
Are you? Yeah, because I lived in Tulsa and I recognize the area code. I lived in Tulsa for like 4 months in the late 90s. So,
are you in snow or?
You know, there was
okay?
One thing that thwarted the Iranian transfer of power in the late 70s. Even though the Shah was popular, the Shia clergy, which is, you know, the Islamic group, they were getting more dissatisfied with the modernization and secularization. And the Shah ended up getting paranoid, and he
he was out there for 5 years. He was nuts.
Yeah, he was in exile at that point. But But the Iranian intelligence agency had a conflict with those who were ruling, and 2,000 people were put into political prisons at that time. Now, according to my statistics, he was exiled. I thought it was only the last 6 months in 1979. Was it for 5 years?
He lived outside of Iran, I forget for how many years. There was so much family turmoil. But Prince Darius lives in Oklahoma. He still has the same phone number he had 15 years ago, you know. And he had tried.
So are you still
he
his
was a
friend?
Young man. Yes. As a young man, he had offered himself to exchange himself for the hostages. And there was quite a bit written about him, but our government wouldn't allow him to. But he's a good
wow.
and decent man. He's a good and decent man. It just
well,
makes me wonder. No. Still, what's
yeah,
in store for him?
I'm not sure, but you know, maybe when you're living in the United States and you feel kind of like, I wonder where he stands as far as his cultural identity, like how he can relate to his country now.
Oh,
because the
U.S.
has shunned Iran.
He doesn't call it Iran. You know, most Persians call it Persia. I mean, that's
right.
what they still call it Persia. And very rarely will they call it Iran unless they're talking to regular people, I guess you could say, but. You know, people that don't see it as Persia, but his love for that country. And I've heard story after story after story. He was born in Switzerland, though, and yeah, there's a lot of connections between Switzerland and the Shah. I mean, I probably should have
right.
wrote some of the stories down.
I had two Persian grad school friends, and I went to Cal State Northridge. One's a painter
oh, okay.
now, and another guy named Ahmed. His brother was killed by the Iranian government probably around 2004, and they shipped his dead body in a coffin to the United States. So I don't know why they did that. I guess it was some kind of political stunt. So
probably so. Probably.
But
so.
There are Iranian. I also knew a Persian liquor store owner. I mean, I just talked to people on the streets. I'm not. I don't feel like I'm that well-versed in Iranian culture. I'm sure you have more exposure. I just know what I hear from people and what it was like before and what it's like now. But that one cleric just, you know, they do have a new transition of power right now. Ahmad Ajenim, I don't know how to say his name. Ahmadinejad. He left and there's a new guy in there now.
No, he's president, right? But as far as does the religious order or religious factions, do they dictate policy or politics, or are they kind of just to the side commenting on everything that goes on?
It's the highest cleric who's the president. That's how it's a theocracy, John.
Wow. I mean, I'm wondering what that area is. One thing we discussed about in earlier shows is that the more percentage of the population that's Muslim, the more extreme the culture gets. You know, if it's 1%, you might have a little problem here or there. If it's 20 or 30%, you start seeing certain areas of a country that there's kind of conflict. But when you get to where there's 60, 70%, they start, changing all the laws I'm trying to think. It's called Sharia law or whatever, where they basically enforce everything that, you know, culturally, like they'll behead you and do those kind of things, cut your hand off kind of behavior. And it's just in these cultures when they get really extremely religious in governing, it just seems like just a lot of it becomes a very violent.
Well, I was
going to
mention
country.
Something about the Saudis. Like, the royal family, 15 to 20 princes control most of the arm of the government, including the courts. So they have full jurisdiction over what's decided in a court. It's not like an American system. But just to mention, the new Iranian president's name is Hassan Rouhani. It used to be Ahmad Majenad. I can't even say his damn name, but it used to...
Yeah.
Yeah, it used to be that other guy. And there's still Right now, this new guy, Rouhani, is negotiating with Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, and the U.S. in Geneva to hammer out a deal to ease up on their nuclear program in exchange for loosening sanctions. So this guy has been more approachable.
Wow.
Well, anyway, you guys, we only have 5 minutes of the show left. So usually we make a summary. So, guest, would you like to go first on the summary?
No, I think I'll just listen. I'll just listen because I didn't get to hear the entire show. So.
Well, I was going to say,
sure.
Is there anything that you would like to see happen in the Middle East as far as the way things are run? Or do you think that the area will improve if more of the religious order is running things, or if they kind of keep it to the side and have more of a democratic kind of process? Or,
well, I don't think democracy is good for the Middle East. I don't think it is. Everybody thinks our version of government is what should be over there, and they're wrong. You know, that's not our world. That's not. Yeah, I don't think we should superimpose our systems over there.
Right.
I think that's inherently wrong, and it
John,
never lasts.
I agree with that because I did a paper on Iraq. And there were 6 conditions for democracy, and Iraq did not meet them. The civil society has to. There has to
we
be a civil society
one.
Foundation in
well,
order
here's
to
a question. Do
establish
that,
different elements of the government
mm-hmm.
system.
Right. Well, long term, I'm speaking for the next like 50 to 100 years. Do you think worldwide, with these countries like Iraq, Iran, and so forth, that we can have world peace, or that they will be able to gain power and yet not impose a violent, you know, structure with the extremists that are in these countries? Do you think that they're able to, the countries can police these groups and keep them to you know, where they can tolerate other countries, or do you think that we're headed, you know, for more chaos on the planet?
Well, John, I want to interject something because we only have 3 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't finish a thought I had earlier. In the 1960s, in the Saudi royal family, which is what we were discussing originally, the senior Al-Saud brothers decided to exile King Saud because he was losing consensus
That's
everywhere
right.
with an economic collapse. So it's kind of funny that they kind of deported one of their own family members. He died in Athens, Greece, where he was exiled to. Now, John and I were talking earlier about Saudi Arabia. What happened was that Nasser was a regional leader in Egypt who was fairly famous and well-liked. He was angry
mm-hmm.
at the Sauds for supporting Israel indirectly through Western alliances. So King Faisal allowed Saudi Arabia to become a sanctuary for extreme Muslims from Egypt and Syria, where the governments were cracking down on fundamentalist scholars. So, John, that was the root of, they allowed them in the country. It was kind of like
uh-huh.
an even-handed exchange for
like a little safe haven for
diplomacy. What they were trying to do is they were trying to prove to adamant Arab countries that they're just as welcoming to Arabic ideas and extreme Islamic, you know, thought lines as other people.
Right.
So it was kind like
was
a
of like
a gesture.
Because they were like, there was
what
a lot of pressure
Kuwait?
On them. Oh, go ahead.
Kuwait is a
Kuwait
Western
in the Bush
export
family.
Country. Well, they're, Kuwait and England are strong ties. The British nationalize their oil industry too, and they're a very westernized
mm-hmm.
They are a capitalistic country, actually.
But the Bush family drilled the first oil well in Kuwait. A lot of people miss that.
Right.
Really? Well,
yes, check it out.
Okay, I know that they are a capitalistic country. It's kind of like a isolated
mm-hmm.
western venue just south of Iraq.
I know you don't
Iraq.
Have much time, so.
Yeah, we only have a minute left. So one of you two can speak. I've already said my piece. John?
No, I was going to say two oil drills in the bush are worth one in America.
John likes to make dumb jokes sometimes.
That's
but
all
I think
right.
You had a
he
really
really
good
thinks
point
our country is a democracy.
I think you had a really good point about how...
John, do you think our country is a democracy?
It's like a republic democracy. We're not pure democracy.
We're a
but,
republic, that's true.
Yeah. But you make a really...